From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, sequester showdown, immigration arguments, Chinese hacking called out, another whopping snow, Congress on recess, but everybody still looking for advantage or the least blame on sequestration. Here's the president.
These cuts are not smart. They are not fair. They will hurt our economy. They will add hundreds of thousands of Americans to the unemployment rolls. This is not an abstraction. People will lose their jobs.
Immigration reform hits some turbulence in Washington and on the hustings. Arizona Senator John McCain got an earful at a town hall back home, as in, where's the dang fence?
You said, build the dang fence. Where's the fence?
In case you missed it, I showed you.
That's not that, a fence.
It's not a fence, it's a banana. We've put up a banana with about $600 million worth of appropriations we have.
And former Democratic Illinois Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. faces a minimum of nearly 4 years in prison after pleading guilty to spending a pile of campaign funds for personal use.
Not a proud day.
I'm sorry I let everybody down.
Can you say you're sorry you let everybody down?
I'm sorry I let everybody down.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with John King of CNN, Laura Meckler of the Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the sequester fester of get a shotgun Joe Biden of China allegedly cyber stealing everything they can get their hands on? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in our studio is John King, chief national correspondent for CNN, visiting fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics, and with me right here. How great. John King, welcome to On Point.
Happy to be here, Tom. It's great to be home.
Yes, welcome home, John, Dorchester boy. And from Washington, Laura Meckler joins us, covers politics and policy for The Wall Street Journal. Laura, welcome back. Great to have you.
Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty weighs in. Hello, Jack.
Also a Dorchester boy.
Yes.
Hello, Tom, John, and Laura.
Big Dorchester reunion. Speaking of reunions, Erskine Bowles, Alan Simpson, the Grand Bargain guys whose plan did not fly, back to talk about sequestration this week. Here's Bowles on Tuesday talking about the way things are going toward sequestration.
They are stupid, stupid, stupid. They're stupid because, first of all,
they're inane.
They are inane. You couldn't look. There's no business in the country that makes its cuts across the board. You go in there and you try to surgically cut those things that have the least adverse effect on productivity.
Are the sequestration cuts stupid or are they inane? Alan Simpson saying, look, something has to be done about debt. Everybody needs to wake up, he said, because some kind, says Simpson, of major change is needed.
Wake up. All right, forget the emotion, fear, guilt, racism, and all the crap that goes with this, and use your brain, for God's sake.
Okay, I don't know that Bowles and Simpson are going to really define where this thing goes, but Laura Meckler, here it is. Congress is out of town, and this debate goes on because we've got the deadline right in front of us. March 1st is coming. Where does this stand? Are we just going over the cliff, and that's that, Laura?
Well, it certainly looks like we're going over the cliff, at least for a little while. There just seems to be no fundamental will in Washington to do anything else. You basically have Republicans who, it was the sort of the strategy behind this was that the Republican Party would never let these take effect because the cuts are so deep to the military. But there's just a stronger strain right now within the Republican Party that they want spending cuts. They want them to happen. And if this is how they have to get them, then so be it. And so be it seems to be where we're headed.
Let's hear the way the arguments are being put. The president saying, you know, we just can't take this. We can't do it. Here he is on Tuesday, surrounded by first responders.
Now Republicans in Congress face a simple choice. Are they willing to compromise to protect vital investments in education and health care and national security and all the jobs that depend on them? Or would they rather put hundreds of thousands of jobs and our entire economy at risk just to protect a few special interest tax loopholes that benefit only the wealthiest Americans and biggest corporations?
There's the president's framing of this whole thing, but Republicans not buying it. In an interview with CNN's Candy Crowley on Sunday, Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming said sequestration is going to happen and there are not going to be new taxes like the president would like to help balance a budget.
These spending cuts are going to go through on March 1st. Taxes are off the table. I've read the Democrat proposal that even Chuck Schumer said is just a chess piece. The American people need to know tax cuts are off the table, and the Republican Party is not in any way going to trade spending cuts for a tax increase.
John King, the whole country can feel like a chess piece here sometimes. But what about this standoff and the way people are framing it? How do you think the country's seeing it? Who's winning? Who's losing? And is this a real spike in the sight of the economy in the effort to really get the budget under control?
I think the country sees it this way. As Erskine Bowles says, no business does it this way. Well, no family does it this way. And every family in America, rich or poor, has had to do this over the last 5 years. And you decide how much money do we have? What can we spend? How much can we put in the credit card? Sure. Mm-hmm. You think about that, too.
And so they don't pull off 3% of everything. 3% of the braces, 3%
one of the car tires.
Right.
So they say, why can't these children in Washington do this? But as Laura noted, this is a miscalculation on the White House part. They thought the Republicans... When this was the president's idea, remember, originally, because he thought the Republicans would never go for it. But more and more Republicans now are willing to take those defense cuts. And more broadly, they think it's their only leverage over the president. Who's winning? In the short term, if you look at public opinion polls, the president has the upper hand because the Republicans in Congress are so out of favor. However, if you're a second-term president, you need a strong economy. He needs a strong economy to give him a little more breathing room in Washington. It makes every debate about money easier if there's more money coming in from a strong economy. So he could win in the short term and lose in the long
term. Win because Americans will believe him when he says this will hurt the economy?
Well, believe him because he sounds reasonable. If you look at the poll, then he has the bully pulpit, so he can communicate more directly. If you look at the polling, people support what he calls a balanced approach, you know, some tax revenue, some of this. But look, the Republicans, he's asking Republicans to give him tax increases twice in 6 weeks. They just gave him some tax increases. They're not going to do that. Will they strike some big grand bargain on tax reform? Yes, but this is about a short-term thing. Here's to Laura's point, though. The Republicans think the president's crying wolf about the severity, at least in the short term, of how this will feel to people. Mm-hmm. And you have another deadline just a few weeks behind March 1st is March 26th for the government shutting down. Republicans think the pain won't be so bad by the time we have to cut another deal. So if this is the only way to have leverage over the president on cuts, so be it.
Jack, how do you read this? And where does this take us on the economy? Where does this take us on coming to terms? Everybody's got a different idea about what's the best way, but in some way, with our financial situation, fiscal.
Well, I think it you know, you could say in the short term, if it goes ahead, it's good for the fiscal situation. It'll reduce the deficit. But, of course, it's any effect there will be offset by the slowdown in the economy. And that could be a percent or more, according to some estimates. And as many as 750,000 jobs could be lost because of the loss of government jobs, but also just stimulus to the rest of the economy. You know, it really is unedifying to see the president yesterday talking to Al Sharpton. He said, my sense, talking to the Republican, is their basic view is nothing is important enough to raise taxes on wealthy individuals or corporations, and they would prefer to see see these kinds of cuts that could slow our economy over closing tax loopholes. Now, you could say that is an accurate political analysis. On the other hand, there's not even a whiff of compromise in that. The president bestirred himself yesterday to call Speaker Boehner and Leader McConnell, but that seems to be as far as he's gone, and you just get the sense that the White House feels we have the politics here, we have the public opinion, the president's at 55%, highest in 2 years, Congress at 19%, but as John says, over the long term, and the long term could be just in some months, he's responsible for the economy, he and his party.
And Americans wondering, why do we have to do things in a stupid way, if that's what this is? Rand Paul, Republican senator out of Kentucky, so desperate for some kind of cuts that he's ready to go with the sequestration. Here he is on CNN on Tuesday.
This is not enough cuts. So we shouldn't be, if we get rid of this, it just shows that we're really not serious as a nation about doing anything about our debt crisis. So I would say to the president, stand up and do the right thing and don't ask us to squeeze more money out of the private sector, which we think is bad for jobs, in order for you to do the right thing. Why doesn't he stand up and be a leader and just do the right thing?
But here's Alan Simpson saying, look, this just isn't going to, the sequester is the wrong way. We've got to look at the big issues in the budget. Here's Simpson.
The sequester isn't really, it's just going to do total disruption because it doesn't touch the two engines that are driving us into eternity, and that is the cost of health care. It doesn't matter what you call it a negative, call it a positive, it can't possibly work. It's on automatic pilot and it will suck up all the discretionary budget of the U.S.
Laura Meckler, where is honesty in this debate? Can you hear somebody who's telling it more or less like it is, or does it all boil down to ideology because nobody can figure it out?
Well, you know, the honesty is in the eye of the beholder. I think it's also fair to say few put things quite as squarely as Alan Simpson manages to. I think the problem that we have is that you have two very conflicting situations going on at the same time. You have both a genuine debate over whether our deficit should be reduced so much by relying on spending cuts, which is what the Republicans say. At the same time, though, I think we have a really important situation about can Washington ever function? Right now, it is just proving itself to be as dysfunctional as ever. And I think there already have been consequences of that in terms of consumer confidence, in terms of the, you know, the ability to get all sorts of things done. And I think that the longer this goes on, if they just continue at this stalemate over, you know, should taxes be included or should they not be, it just bodes so poorly for our future as a sort of a governing institution, Congress and the White House together. So I think that the White House, you know, is right to say, okay, yes, we're winning now, but what's going to happen down the line? You know, he does have four more years. He is going to have to deal with Congress.
John King, half a minute before the break here. Republicans just did give up a tax hike at the first of the year, but of course there were tax cuts one after another under George Bush, and here we are.
Here we are, and the problem here is, Laura just talked about a governing institution. We don't have one. The United States government has not had a real budget in 16 years. 16 years since they last actually passed a budget the way they're supposed to. And so this isn't the first.
Loony.
It is loony. This isn't the first time we've done this, and a lot of Americans are probably saying, here we go again. But this president and this Republican Congress have taken the dysfunction, the trust deficit, to new lows.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at a week in the news, sequester debate, immigration friction, Chinese hacking, and more. John King, chief national correspondent for CNN, is with us right here with me in the studio today, and it's great to have him. Laura Meckler joins us from Washington, staff writer covering politics and policy for The Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to our listeners. Andrew in Amherst, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. To me, this sequester looks like it would serve the Republicans' purpose if they can keep it in place and hurt the economy and then try to blame it on the Democrats and the president.
Okay, but the president's not going to run for office again. They could blame it on Democrats, but, you know, after a while, doesn't everybody get tired of a bad economy?
Well, how do the Republicans feel like they can position themselves to get back into power and that just make the Democrats be in a position where people want to blame the economy on them, and they can get back into power.
Let us pick it up. John King, not 4 but 8 years of make sure it doesn't work?
Well, there's a flip side to that, too, though. There's no question some Republicans, again, on the policy side, they see that in every negotiation they have not been able to get the kinds of cuts, the deepest cuts that they want, so they think this is their only leverage over the president, number one. But number two, there's a flip side to that. Mm-hmm. You know, the president publicly is saying this is horrible, this is horrible. If you talk to people privately at the White House, they say, fine, we'll just blame the Republicans when this happens. And there's a calculation in the White House, there's a possibility he can get the House back in 2014 and for the last 2 years of his term have a Democratic Congress again. So there's 2014 politics at play here. Sorry, Americans, you want your country governed with some reason and rationality. Well, good luck.
Politics right away. Amanda in Waynesboro, Tennessee. Amanda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a modest proposal.
All right.
It is that the first cuts for this should be congressional salaries and their offices in their home district and all that good stuff.
Shut it down. Sequester right there. But we need someone to govern and we need someone to deal with our issues. What would you like them to do if they were going to act in a wise way? What would you like them to do, Amanda?
I'd have no idea. It seems like we are not governed right now, but seems like they could work for free for a week or two and get things under control.
Amanda, you want to get it right up at the congressional throat. We've got it. One more here. Skeeter in Huntington, Vermont. Skeeter, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty clear to me that the Republicans are living in fiscal never land.
That's what they say about Democrats, Skeeter.
They are in denial of the fact that they created this fiscal crisis in the first place when they controlled both houses of Congress during the Bush administration, and they never stood up to President Bush's spending and $800 billion in Treasury draining tax cuts. The fact that they created this mess in the first place, and they're not willing to own up to it, I think it's pretty clear. And the fact that they're willing to continue to obstruct, in spite of the fact that they lost last November's election, should send a very clear signal that they are out of touch with mainstream America.
Skeeter, we've got it. We've got it loud and clear. Your perspective there. Laura Meckler, what do you think finally stops this merry-go-round of political football? Or does anything? Does it just go on and, I don't know.
I think that the caller is reflecting to some extent the mood in Washington, which is people enjoy blaming each other more than they enjoy coming up with solutions. Both sides have spent an inordinate amount of time in recent days trying to say, no, the sequester was your idea. It was your idea. This is the situation. We're in this because of you. It doesn't really get you anywhere at the end of the day. All it is political posturing to try to set up for 2014, as John was talking about, or to try to, you know, see if you can win this round. And I think that that's what so many Americans are so frustrated about Washington about.
Jack, are you going into your bunker up there in New Hampshire when the sequester hits? Do you think it's going to be really bad? Or you know, come on, we'll just be talking about the next thing.
Well, it looks, you know, the Times yesterday said it looks like it's going to happen and happen for the rest of the fiscal year. So that's up until what, October? In the meantime, Karl Rove has come up with a characteristically clever, some might say Machiavellian proposal. And that is that the Congress pass a bill giving the president authority to rationally allocate these cuts. In other words, he's not now allowed to say, well, we can't cut this because it's vital, but we'll cut that. He doesn't have that discretionary authority. Rove says, give it to him. Let him decide. Let him take the blame for what hurts. And there's some thought on that I've seen, at least. Tom Davis, the former Virginia congressman, says that's being talked about in Republican circles. Let the president have some discretion, and he'll take the blame for the cuts.
We'll see. Let's move to immigration. It has had a big head of steam on it, immigration policy reform. And then this week, we heard John McCain there at the top of the show getting roughed up at a town hall meeting in Arizona. And there was this in an interview on NPR on Thursday. Republican Virginia Congressman, Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Goodlatte said he does not support a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants.
People have a pathway to citizenship right now. It's to abide by the immigration laws. And if they have a family relationship, they have a job skill that allows them to do that, they can obtain citizenship. But simply, someone who broke the law came here, say, I'll give you citizenship now. That, I don't think, is going to happen.
Laura Meckler, what do you make of that? If he doesn't think that's going to happen, that's some kind of path to citizenship, what does that say about the whole push for immigration reform?
Well, what it says is that the Republican Party is not united on this. What we've seen since the November election is a, you know, extraordinary move inside the Republican Party toward immigration reform, including a path to citizenship. And there are a lot of people who support that who haven't supported it in the past. Having said that, that is hardly a universal view, as Chairman Goodlatte made clear. And he's not just any old member of Congress. He's chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. So there's long been a question exactly of how this bill is going to navigate its way through Congress. But what most people think is that the Senate, which is very actively working on legislation now, is going to come up with something, pass it, they hope, with a big bipartisan vote. It will then go to the House. And then they have to do some sort of internal politicking there. I suspect that if a bill with a path to citizenship and it came to the House floor, it would have a very good chance of passing with dissent from people like Mr. Goodlatte. But that's going to be a difficult position for House Speaker John Boehner, who will be disappointing a large number of his party, annoying a large number of his party if he goes forward with a path like that. And I'll just make one other point, which is that even though the sort of National Republican Party and the sort of the big thinkers within the GOP really see an imperative to act on immigration in terms of the party's long-term standing with Hispanics. For most rank-and-file Republicans, that really isn't their concern. Their political concerns are much more about a primary that they might be faced and challenged from the right, as we heard from the pushback John McCain got, than ever being faced with a tough general election, because most of those seats are very safe.
Which puts them up against a real challenge there, potentially always from that angle. I mean, John King, we had the White House immigration plan leaked this week, and among other things in there, an 8-year path for maybe 11 million in the country illegally to qualify for citizenship, 4-year transition period for employers to implement systems to verify the legal status of people that they're going to hire. How do you read where this is headed, John?
Well, this is a more political mischief in the sense that the president had said publicly he would let Congress do its business and only send up his plan if they failed, give them a chance, stay out of the way. And a lot of Democrats who want this passed guests who want a more comprehensive sweeping package passed have been urging the White House, and immigration reform advocates urging the White House, be quiet, or at least be more quiet. Mm-hmm. Lay out your principles and then be quiet, because don't make this about you and the Republicans, because then you'll drive away some conservative support. So why did the White House do this? Republicans don't like it. In part, the president has an easier path to citizenship than the Republicans.
Yes.
The Republican proposals are a couple, so I'm generalizing a bit, mm-hmm. but it's an easier path to citizenship, and that, to many Republicans, is too long of a time for the transition for employers to start getting tougher about verification. So what did the president do here? He poked the other side. Now, Laura made a key point about the process. They need a big vote in the Senate to give Boehner some breathing room on the House side to go to his people and say, look.
I mean, a big majority,
bipartisan mm-hmm. vote. They need 70 votes. They need to be able to say, look, a lot of Republicans did this in the Senate. Now we have to do it in the House.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about Chairman Goodlatte is you heard him there say, I don't support a path to citizenship. But it's interesting. You know, if you want a bill like this, you might think, oh, that guy's in the way. The chairman just last year was Lamar Smith of Texas,
right.
excuse me. He was much more anti. He would have said, hell no. He mm-hmm. would have said amnesty mm-hmm. over my dead body.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Goodlatte doesn't like it either, but he's more of a Boehner guy. So the question is, what does he let out of committee? And Laura makes a key point. The committee decides what gets to the House floor. And then your question is this. What if the House passes legal status but not path to citizenship? This is a test of the president. He says it has
no
to be
kidding.
A path to citizenship.
Yeah. Yeah.
Will he take a bill that says legal status? You can stay and you can work, but you're never going to be a citizen. Or will he use the issue heading into 2014? Well,
that'll be an issue for the president and for the whole country. Jack, I'll come to you right here, but let me just play a little bit from Paul Ryan first. He was on This Week, ABC's on Sunday, talking about the leak of the White House immigration proposal. This is Paul Ryan here.
Leaking this out does set things in the wrong direction. Look, the question that we always have to ask ourselves, particularly with this White House, is the president looking for a partisan advantage, or is he looking for a bipartisan law?
Jack, how do you read this? And what if the White House is presented with, you know, legal status, but that ID card, but never citizenship? No path there for all those millions.
I can't imagine that he could sign that because it would essentially, well, it would muddy the water completely. It would alienate the 71%. It would essentially betray that 70% vote he got from Hispanic Americans. That's at least the way their organizations would represent it. And, you know, but what it was interesting, right after the inaugural, I think Paul Ryan was saying, oh, the president sounds like he's going to be statesmanlike about this. He's not going to use immigration. He doesn't want the issue. He wants the bill. Now he says they're afraid he wants the issue. And, you know, this isn't a win for Republicans. I understand that's the way it's represented. We have to change. We have to get right. But if you look at the magazines, the National Review, for example, they say there's nothing in it for us here. These folks, when finally this get shaken out in another generation, probably because of all the hoops and swirls of the thing, these folks aren't going to vote for us. And in the meantime, the Democrats are just going to say, well, we didn't get as good a deal as we want because of those laggard Republicans, those nativists. There's nothing in it for us here. And if that view grows, that could scupper the deal.
Let's go to Elizabeth in Savannah, Georgia. Elizabeth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Regarding immigration, mm-hmm. We have a number of friends who have immigrated legally over the years from Egypt, from Cuba, mm-hmm. from Canada, mm-hmm. from India, and they look askance when they see immigrants who enter our country illegally and think to themselves, well, why did we go through the wickets? And
it takes a long time to do it right and a lot of effort.
Exactly. And they're thinking, why in the world did our families uproot and immigrate, or did we uproot and immigrate and go through the long process legally when we could have just entered illegally and been granted certain rights?
But Elizabeth, let me ask you, on the other hand, what about the idea of giving, you know, sort of legal status cards to 10, 11 more million people, but not putting them ever on a path to citizenship? Does that create a good situation for them or for this country, more importantly?
I don't think it does. But on the other hand, both parties from President Bush, the first Bush onward, have granted some sort of, I don't want to say citizenship, but some sort of rights as to our illegal aliens in this country. It's a conundrum. It really, really is. I do not know what the answer is. I feel for the individuals who have come here seeking a better life, I want them to seek a better life, but I wish that they could do so legally.
Amen to that, but we've got to get our hands around this. Laura, what do you say?
Well, a few points. One, part of this immigration bill is going to be reforms to our legal immigration system because it has a lot of problems of its own. It doesn't get as much attention, but that's definitely going to be part of any comprehensive bill. Secondly, I think it's important to note that there's been a lot of attention on the legal status versus path to citizenship. But just the fact that that's where the debate right now shows how much it has moved. I mean, if you would have asked a year ago Republicans like Bob Goodlatte, would you support legal status for 11 million people in this country, I suspect he would have called that amnesty just as well. So the debate has shifted quite a bit. And I would just also say to the caller's point, the people who came here illegally, I could have just come illegally. Being an illegal immigrant in this country is a pretty tough road, a pretty tough life. So it's not anything that I don't think any of us would really choose. Having said that, they did break the law, and there are efforts as they're trying to craft this legislation to strike a balance to say, okay, you've got to wait for your turn for citizenship until everybody who has been waiting legally gets their green cards first and those sorts of things. But it's a tough balance to strike.
Let's turn to another big one on Capitol Hill, guns. Joe Biden did that from a couple of different angles this week. Here he was on Thursday, the vice president, talking about gun control at Western Connecticut State University, just miles from Newtown, Connecticut, urging Washington politicians to act, saying the climate has changed.
I believe the price to be paid politically to those who refuse to act, who refuse to step forward. Because America has changed on this issue. You should all know the American people are with us.
And then our shoot-from-the-hip vice president at a Facebook town hall on Tuesday responded to a question on a potential ban on assault rifles, people who were nervous about their safety, saying this.
You don't need an AR-15. It's harder to aim, it's harder to use, and in fact, you don't need 30 rounds to protect yourself. Buy a shotgun. Buy a shotgun.
Jack Beatty, there's our Jolton Joe. Buy a shotgun, buy a shotgun. He's our gun control guy. But hey, it's maybe it's better than an assault rifle with a 30, 40-round magazine.
Yes, indeed. And it's certainly better than a handgun. I mean, you can't hide it. The event in Connecticut featured a woman who lost a child to this to Newtown. Her name was Lynn McDonald, and just think of what it costs for her to stand up there and say, we owe it to our children, and I owe it to my daughter, Grace. I mean, it's just unimaginable what these people are going through. And now they're sort of, counters in a political argument.
Let's go to Mike in Katy's, Kentucky. Mike, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I was calling. I heard Joe Biden's speech, so I went out and bought a shotgun, but I bought a shotgun that takes a 20-round magazine.
Oh, there's always another way. Now, what are you going to do with the 20-round magazine on your shotgun, Mike?
I shoot sporting clays in the backyard. I would like to buy an AR, but since this whole debate of gun controls came out, it's done nothing but make it impossible to buy one. Manufacturers can't make them fast enough, and it's double prices in 2 months.
An effective ban because they can't make them fast enough. Get them while they're hot. Mike, good luck with shooting in the backyard. John, where do you see this one going?
I think it's great. The timing there was great that we have a caller from Kentucky, because when you listen to this debate, one of the gifts of my job is I get to travel the country. Mm-hmm. And I understand why somebody in New York City or the city of Boston or in an urban center might say, why are there so many guns out there? But remember, it is spelled out in the Constitution. There is a right to bear arms. Now, the debate should be about what are reasonable restrictions to that right, because a lot of our rights are restricted in some ways. However, a lot of people who have passionate views about this, and God bless them for those views, need to remember, if you go to Kentucky, even Colorado, where the Aurora shooting happened, listen to Governor Hickenlooper, a Democratic governor, a former mayor, who says, look, I'll look at this debate. I'll have an open mind, but guns aren't the problem. It's the mental health system and everything. So this is one of the many issues on which the country refuses to have a calm conversation. Everybody gets passionate and goes off into their corners. If you travel the country, there's a lot of support. About 47% of Americans have a gun in
Let's
their
get
home.
A handle on some kind on this, a reasonable handle.
Let's try to have a conversation without thinking, if you have a gun, if you just bought that shotgun with 20 clips, there are some people saying, who is that? They want to use tough words. Let's drop that and let's try to have a calm conversation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, one dead, 15 injured in Kansas City after a huge natural gas explosion flattened part of the decades-old restaurant JJ's. Local Marek Brzozowski told the Kansas City Star he was shaken wide awake by the blast.
I looked outside and saw just a massive fireball coming out of where JJ's used to be. It just was the biggest fire I'd ever seen.
Where JJ's used to be. Coverage all over of the Oscar Pistorius murder case. Kim Martin, cousin of the victim, girlfriend Reva Steenkamp, told CNN's Piers Morgan she wants to believe Oscar's story, that her cousin died in an accident and not in a raging murder.
That is what, in my heart, I hope and wish is the truth, because I would not like to think that my cousin suffered.
And on a good cancer news front, ABC's Robin Roberts returned to Good Morning America 5 months after a bone marrow transplant.
Hi, it's Robin, and I have been waiting 174 days to say this. Good morning, America.
Good to see good news there. We're looking at a week in the news: sequester debate, immigration debate, Chinese hacking, big snows off the plains. You can join us. Is Joe Biden right? Just get a shotgun? What do you think of Jesse Jackson Jr.'s sticky fingers and all that rich junk he bought? Could we have an American Pope, His Holiness O'Malley? And do you have Pistorius fever, fixation? Why? With Laura Meckler of the Wall Street Journal, John King, chief national correspondent for CNN, with me in the studio today, and Jack Beatty. Let's turn to that hacking. Private company did a lot of sleuthing, tracked a whole bunch of it down, and it goes to a Chinese military unit in the suburbs of Shanghai. Of course, this stuff is notoriously hard to track, but they said, wow, lots of roads leading there. China's foreign ministry spokesman Hong Lei denied reports that the Chinese military was involved in hacking of American computers.
We have stressed many times that hacking attacks are transnational and anonymous. Determining their origins is extremely difficult. We don't know how the evidence in this so-called report can be tenable.
But we know a lot of things have been, a lot of computers have been hacked, a lot of important industrial and other information. Pretty much straight up stolen. How do we deal with this? I mean, we've got, you know, it's funny online here, John, Laura, Jack, Dwight writes to us on Facebook, crazy that Chinese hackers are the least of our worries, greatest danger facing America right now at U.S. Congress. But Ben writes to us, just a quick update, while the thought of Chinese hacking is important, do not make the failed assumption that all corporate or government hacking is from China. Eastern Europe, South America also have interested parties. Well, fair enough. But here it is, John, and there are just much more than footprints all over the place here. And we might as well call it for what it is. A whole lot of it does go back to China.
And it's government against government espionage. It's corporate espionage, if you want to call it that. And the gentleman is right in saying it comes from all over the world. Welcome to the world of technology. Some of this is some guy in his basement somewhere in Eastern Europe, maybe. But a lot of this now, if there's they won't publicly give us all the evidence, but I've been talking to people at the Pentagon for years who say they're sure most of it's coming from China. So if you look at the pie of this, a very big slice of that pie is coming from China. What do you do about it? Number one, our government is ill-equipped. Post 9/11, Iraq War, Afghanistan War, a lot of the money has gone to those efforts, not to building up the cyber effort.
Though they're talking lately about beefing it up plenty.
And I've talked to the former CIA director, George Tenet. This is what he does. He says he spends a lot of time in corporate boardrooms now telling corporate America, you must. You can't count on the government to get ahead of you on this. You better get ahead of the government on this, working on defending yourself, protecting yourself.
But the government talking about helping out with that in the most overt way I can recall this week here was Mike Rogers, Republican congressman from Michigan, on Wednesday, chairman of the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, talking with MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell about how the U.S. might get tougher on hackers, Chinese hackers.
We need to take other aggressive steps. We need to start identifying these individuals, looking at maybe denying visas of their families, start taking it as serious as it is consequential to American businesses. And I can't tell you how serious this problem is. There is two companies left in America, Andrew. One is those companies that have been hacked and know it, and two, the companies who have been hacked and don't know it.
Industrial espionage, national security espionage, and Laura Meckler, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. But can this really be stopped, or can you put up somehow a price for it that you could deter China or anybody else from doing it?
I don't know if we can ever really stop it or not. There's sort of a fight that's happening on a couple different fronts. You have the government trying to look at it from a diplomatic point of view, which is, historically very difficult to do, very difficult to deal with China on this, because when they get confronted, they say, well, hacking is against our laws. Of course we don't do that, and which is just sort of laughable given the evidence that's out there. On the other hand, you have the sort of defense, which is which the Obama administration is encouraging companies to do, which is to really not assume your firewall is safe and take progressive, you know, aggressive action to try to protect your systems. So, you know, I think that the thing about this week is that suddenly we have seen an escalation in sort of the way that people view this issue. It's long been an issue, as John said. I mean, this is not new to the people who know about it at all. But it seems like in this last week, based partly on that report from the private consulting firm and some other developments, that people are now just starting to really tune into this and try to take it seriously. So, you know, maybe there can be some headwinds made, but I doubt it will ever be stopped.
Jack Beatty, I mean, you want to be fair on this. After all, it's not as though the U.S. doesn't do any cyber stuff. Ask Iran about that. On the other hand, you know, if the Chinese military marched into a factory or something in Silicon Valley or San Diego, the U.S. government would respond to that. So when it's just happens to be digital, but they're sucking all kinds of work out of there that people have put a lot of effort into that has great value, what do you do?
What indeed, and you know, this Mandiant report, it says, quote, exposing one of China's cyber espionage units. One. I mean, that implies there's more to come here. And of course, the report goes on to point out that they have targeted four of the seven strategic emerging industries that they targeted, that they laid out in their last 12-year plan. So they're going right after secrets they need. Now, of course, in history, industrial espionage has been one of the ways that the nations have progressed.
Look at our looms in New England.
Francis Lowell went to Europe. He went to London, came back, Birmingham. Sketched it down, and along went Lowell, and up went the Industrial Revolution in America. So these things happen, but this
copyright
is just,
we ignored it for years and years when Europeans were pumping it out.
Absolutely, and but it just and then when people say, well, what to do about it? I heard James Fallows, our friend, the China expert, talking. He said, well, you really can't confront them about this because that will challenge their face. They will have to deny it. You can't shame China. Well, if you can't shame them, and you can't treat it as if the equivalent of an invasion of a factory, what in fact do you do? You know, last year a bill was defeated in Congress that had the Lieberman bill that would have given some element of security to our private networks, and that was defeated on sort of anti-government grounds. Yeah. We've got to do better than that. We can't let ideology stand in the way of protecting us.
You treat face with diplomacy, but face can't trump everything else. John Kerry, new Secretary of State, talking about the world this week and saying, look, all this stuff abroad, and maybe this cyber theft thing brings this right home, but saying all this isn't just over there. Americans have to stop thinking about it as distant, foreign, not engaged with them. Here's Kerry arguing this was at the University of Virginia for the importance of U.S. foreign policy, pushing for full funding of foreign aid.
In today's global world, there is no longer anything foreign about foreign policy. More than ever before, the decisions that we make from the safety of our shores don't just ripple outward. They also create a current right here in America.
Secretary of State Kerry headed out to the Europe and the Middle East soon. Jack, do you think he's going to bring foreign issues home to Americans in a new way, more than Hillary Rodham Clinton?
Well, he's talking that way. You know, a poll for the Chicago Institute of Foreign Affairs last year found that Americans want jobs to be the number one priority of our foreign policy. And this speech was peppered with that, talking about companies we're bringing from South Africa, talking about trade relations here and that sort. But crucially, it comes back to this. He's trying to remind the public. He said there was recently a question in opinion poll, how big is our international affairs budget? Americans thought 25%. He said, folks, it's less than 1% of our budget, and we need to use that money to deal with problems diplomatically, so we won't have to deal with them militarily. He made that argument again and again. He said that the State Department's conflict stabilization budget, for example, is $60 million a year, which is how much the movie The Avengers took in on a single Sunday last May,
okay.
which brings it home. And he talked about the value of foreign aid. But you know what? Senator Kerry in 2009 in the Senate, I think almost unanimously, passed an aid bill to Pakistan. I think that was as much as $7 billion over a period of years of non-military aid. And, you know, with no restrictions on the Pakistan government, they didn't have to produce any accounting for this. And partly that was to avoid, giving the impression America was suborning them. Oh, no. And it was deeply unpopular in Pakistan. There's no check on what they're doing with the money. And that is, that's the kind of thing American citizens see and say, wait a minute, $7 billion to Pakistan without any accounting on it?
Well,
this is foreign policy?
He'll be out on the hoof in a hurry. President Obama behind him on his way to Israel soon. In this general neck of the woods, John King, what about Chuck Hagel and his nomination for Secretary of Defense? Where is that headed?
I think it is headed most likely, almost certainly, to a vote next week and that he will be confirmed. He will be bruised. He did not, carry himself well in the confirmation process. And even people at the White House who supported his nomination are frankly furious with him. They think that he just took it for granted. My old buddies in the Senate will be nice to me. Oh, they talk to Republicans.
Silly man.
Silly man. He didn't do his homework. He wasn't prepared. He got his own about to be his new administration's policies wrong on a couple points, and he seemed a bit distant on some questions and a bit arrogant on others. However, the White House has done the work here. It looks like they have the votes, and this will be done when Congress comes back. The Republicans held it up for sport, shall we say. But it's interesting. So then how is his stature? Here's a Republican who's going to have to help squeeze money out of the Pentagon, number one. More broadly, on the philosophical questions, you add John Kerry to the team, Chuck Hagel, two Vietnam veterans who, if you go back through the time, are very clear on the record about their reluctance, their much higher bar for the projection of U.S. military force
war
overseas. So I think you do see philosophically a team that wants to think more about, our image in the world, diplomacy in the world, but Iraq, Afghanistan in the rearview mirror.
Let's bring it back to politics on another level. Jesse Jackson Jr., just kind of, sad, crazy, I'm not sure what to call it this week, news coming out that he told a judge that he was guilty of misusing $750,000 or more in campaign money, buying flat-screen TVs, a pair of stuffed elk heads, $40,000 Rolex watch, a fedora that belonged to Michael Jackson, Eddie Van Halen's guitar, shopping trips to Build-A-Bear. Here's yesterday. This is an interview with MSNBC. His dad, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, pledging to support his son, Jesse Jackson Jr., who pled guilty Wednesday to charges of misusing those funds.
Well, it's been a long ordeal, number one, but a very sad day. Even at this on his saddest day, I was so proud of him being forthright and truthful, accepting responsibilities for his actions, and willing to accept the consequence of those actions. And that is the dignity that he embraces, and I support him in those efforts.
Not a proud day. We heard Jesse Jr. saying at the top of the show, Laura Meckler, do you have a handle on what's going on here? The word last one was last fall that he kind of disappeared from sight. Then the word was that he had been diagnosed. Was it bipolar or something? Was there anything to that? Are these things related? Was that just a smokescreen? What's going on?
I really don't know. I mean, does bipolar disease make you want to buy stuffed elk heads?
Could.
I mean,
Eddie Van Halen's guitar, yes.
It's stunning. I mean, I just find it stunning that you have somebody who had that much potential, that much political power, who had such great ambitions, and you see how some people end up in difficult situations or make mistakes, and sometimes they kind of make sense even when you know they're wrong. This, to use campaign funds to buy things that are just so clearly over the top and ridiculous, is just something I think that nobody really understands, and I certainly don't.
Jack, look, I'm Illinois born and bred, and we've had our train of horribles out of there, but how on earth could anybody reasonably think you could, stuff that much money into Build-A-Bear and stuffed elk heads, and it wouldn't be a problem?
I know, and it was the couple, his wife Sandy is also going to be sentenced. She failed to report nearly $600,000 in taxable income over 6 years, and she's going to be sentenced. They have two children. I mean, it's an ugly business, and it echoes something I think that's just so emblematic. We have had elites behaving badly. Is just you can almost write a history of this time with that, and it is so important to discourage the others. that they be published and that they be punished, and also to satisfy us, our feeling of, by God, you shouldn't get away with that. And last Friday, Elizabeth Warren, I think, really in a very important question to our regulators, said, how many of these banks have you brought to trial? And they said, well, we really haven't brought it. And she said, well, why? Why can't you bring any of them to trial? And they basically said, well, they were too big to try. I mean, and Americans just feel, especially about that Wall Street elite, yeah. My God, somebody's got to pay for this wreckage of our economy.
It was last week, but it got a big workout this week. Here's the Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. This was at her first Senate Banking Committee, grilling regulators over settling with big Wall Street firms instead of bringing them to trial. What, Build-A-Bear versus the billions. Here's Warren.
Tell me a little bit about the last few times you've taken the biggest financial institutions on Wall Street all the way to a trial. Anybody?
I think that's called a smattering of applause. Laura Meckler, does that make red faces, or is everybody just past that, beyond that in Washington?
It hasn't gotten a huge amount of attention right now, I think partly because there's sort of a sense that that's a story that kind of is yesterday's news, and partly because it gets, you know, pushed out by all the active stuff that's going on now between the sequester and immigration and guns and everything else that we've talked about today. Mm. So I don't think that it has gotten a lot of attention, but I do think there are certainly people in the Elizabeth Warren camp who, you know, there were more people applauding than we heard in that clip.
Hey, John, meanwhile, the Vatican is, thinking about a new pope, and whispers in the Italian press this week that it, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff on the table, but it could be an American, Sean O'Malley out of Boston, Cardinal, or is it going to be, His Holiness O'Malley?
Yeah, this is to be a fly on the wall in this debate would be great. They're also talking about changing the rules a bit so they can do this sooner rather than later to move quickly because they think they need new leadership as quickly
as possible.
Italian
saying also he's Irish-American, which gives some different new thing there. He's a Ph.D. in Spanish, literature, so brings that in.
I mean, you've heard talk about going, to South or Latin America for that demographic as well, to Africa maybe for the growth of the church. It would be an interesting to pick an American pope, and especially somebody from Boston, given the scandal issues here. What's the choice there? Are you raising the scandal again? Are you reminding everybody about
or
the
saying he dealt with it maybe?
The American Catholic Church, or are you saying, see, this is proof we're turning the page? That would this, you know, this is politics too. It might seem far away. It might be in a secretive place like the Vatican, but it's all politics.
Jackie's got a round trip ticket, he says, but what do you think?
Watch for that smoke.
Yeah.
That puff of smoke. It could say O'Malley.
O'Malley in the sky, the famous puff of smoke.
No.
Gosh. Laura, you got a view on that
no
one?
No exit polls on the Pope.
Yeah, right. Well, it's a very tiny circle, maybe too small to poll. Wow, how great to have you all here. Laura Meckler in Washington, covering politics and policy for the Wall Street Journal. Always great to have you, Laura. Thanks for being
here. Thank
you. John King, right here in the studio. Come by any time, my friend. Great to have you.
My pleasure.
John King, Chief National Correspondent for CNN. And Jack, many thanks to you, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.